Owl Beast, there's food to be eaten.
You find that more a task than ye talk,
Biggrin retorted. It felt a sudden stinging in its chest, but it grunted away the pain.
I've felt the best that ye can hit, and still I come at ye. Ye can no hope to win.
Both Drizzt and Wulfgar feared that there was more truth to the giant's boasts than either of them would admit. They were on their last legs, wounded and winded, yet determined to stay and finish the task. But the complete confidence of the great giant, as it steadily approached, was more than a little unnerving. Biggrin realized that something was terribly wrong when it got within a few steps of the two companions. Wulfgar and Drizzt knew, too, for the giant's strides suddenly slowed visibly. The giant looked at them in outrage, as though it had been deceived.
Dogs!
It gasped, a gout of blood bursting from its mouth.
What trick?
Biggrin fell dead, without another word.
Should we go after the cat? Wulfgar asked when they got back to the secret door.
Drizzt was wrapping a torch out of some rags he had found. Faith in the shadow, he answered. Guinevar will not let the Verbeek escape. Besides, I have a good meal waiting for me back in the cave.
You go, Wulfgar told him. I shall stay here and watch for the cat's return.
Drizzt clasped the big man's shoulder as he started to leave. They had been through a lot in the short time they had been together, and Drizzt suspected that the excitement was just beginning. The drow sang a feasting song as he started to the main passage, but only as it dodged to Wulfgar, for the dinner table wouldn't be his first stop. The giant they had spoken with earlier had been evasive when asked about what lay down the one tunnel they had yet to explore, and with everything else they had found, Drizzt believed that could only mean one thing. Treasure. The great panther loped along over the broken stones, easily gaining on the heavy-footed giant. Soon, Guinevar could hear the Verbeeg's labored breathing as the creature struggled with every leap and climb. The giant was making for Dale Drop and the open tundra beyond, but so frenzied was its flight that it didn't move off the face of Kelvin's cairn to the easier ground of the valley. It sought a straighter route, believing it to be the quicker path to safety. Guinevar knew the areas of the mountain as well as its master, knew where every creature on the mountain laired. The cat had already discerned where it wanted the giant to go. Like a shepherd's dog, it closed the remaining distance and scratched at the giant's flanks, veering it into the direction of a deep mountain pool. The terrified Verbeek, certain that the deadly warhammer or darting scimitar weren't far behind, didn't dare stop and engage the panther. It surged blindly along the path Guinevar had chosen. A short time later, Guinevar broke away from the giant and raced ahead. When the cat reached the edge of the cold water, it tilted its head and concentrated its keen senses, hoping to spy something that could help it complete the task. Then Guinevar noticed a tiny shimmer of movement under the sparkles of the first light on the water. Its sharp eyes sorted out the long shape lying deathly still. Satisfied that the trap was set, Guinevar moved back behind a nearby ledge to wait. The giant lumbered up to the pool, breathing heavily. It leaned against a boulder for a moment, despite its terror. Things seemed safe enough for the moment. As soon as it had caught its breath, the giant looked around quickly for signs of pursuit, then started forward again. There was only one path across the pool, a fallen log that spanned the center, and all the alternative routes around the pool, though the water wasn't very wide, weaved around sheer drops and jutting rock faces and promised to be slow going. The Verbeek tested the log. It seemed sturdy, so the monster cautiously started across. The cat waited for the giant to get close to the center of the pool, then charged from its hiding place and launched itself into the air at the Verbeek. The cat landed heavily into the surprised giant, planting its paws in the monster's chest and rebounding back toward the safety of the shore. Guinevar splashed into the icy pool, but scrambled quickly out of the perilous water. The giant, though, swung its arms wildly for a moment, trying to hold its precarious balance, then toppled in with a splash. The water rushed up to suck it down. desperately, the giant lunged for a nearby floating log, the shape that Guinevere had recognized earlier. But as the Verbeeg's hands came down, the form it had thought to be a log exploded into movement as the 50-foot water constrictor threw itself around its prey with dizzying speed. The unrelenting coils quickly pinned the giant's arms to its side and began their merciless squeeze. Guinevere shook the freezing water from its glistening black coat and looked back to the pool. As yet another length of the monstrous snake locked under the Verbeeg's chin and pulled the helpless monster under the surface, the panther was satisfied that the mission was complete. With a long, loud roar proclaiming victory, Guinevere bounded off toward the lair. 19. Grim Tidings. Drizzt padded through the tunnels and past the bodies of the dead giants, slowing only to grab another hunk of mutton from the large table. He crossed through the support beams and started down the dim hallway, tempering his eagerness with common sense. If the giants had hidden their treasure down here, the chamber holding it might be behind a concealed door, or there might even be some beast, though not likely another giant, since it would have joined in the fighting. The tunnel was quite long, running straight northward, and Drizzt figured that he was now moving underneath the mass of Kelvin's cairn. He had passed the last torch, but he was glad for the darkness. He had lived the majority of his life traveling tunnels in the lightless subterranean world of his people, and his large eyes guided him in absolute darkness more accurately than in areas of light. The hallway ended abruptly at a barred, iron-bound door, its metal holding bar locked into place by a large chain and padlock. Drizzt felt a pang of guilt for leaving Wulfgar behind. The drow had two weaknesses. Foremost was the thrill of battle, but a close second was the tingle of uncovering the booty of his vanquished foes. It wasn't the gold or gems that lured Drizzt. He didn't care for wealth and rarely even kept any of the treasures he had won. It was simply the thrill of viewing them for the first time, the excitement of sifting through them and perhaps discovering some incredible artifact that had been lost to knowledge in ages past, or maybe the spellbook of an ancient and powerful mage. His guilt flew away as he pulled a small lockpick from his belt pouch. He had never been formally trained in the thieving arts, but he was as agile and coordinated as any master burglar. With his sensitive fingers and acute hearing, he wasn't particularly challenged by the clumsy lock. In a matter of seconds, it fell open. Drizzt listened carefully for any sounds behind the door. Hearing none, he gently lifted the large bar and set it aside. Listening one last time, he drew one of his scimitars, held his breath in anticipation, and pushed in the door. His breath came back out with a disappointed sigh. The room beyond glowed with the waning light of two torches. It was small and empty, except for a large, metal-rimmed mirror standing in its center. Drizzt dodged out of the mirror's path, well aware of some of the strange magical properties these items had been known to exhibit, and moved in to examine it more closely. It was about half the height of a man, but propped up to eye level by an intricately worked iron stand. That it was lined in silver, and in such an out-of-the-way chamber, led Drizzt to believe that there was something more here than an ordinary mirror. Yet his scrutinizing inspection revealed no arcane runes or markings of any kind that hinted at its properties. Able to discover nothing unusual about the piece, Drizzt carelessly stepped in front of the glass. Suddenly, a pinkish mist began to swirl within the mirror, giving the appearance of a three-dimensional space trapped within the flatness of the glass. Drizzt jumped to the side, more curious than afraid, and watched the growing spectacle. The mist thickened and puffed, as though fed by some hidden fire. Then its center mushroomed out and opened into a clear image of a man's face, a gaunt, hollowed visage painted in the tradition of some of the southern cities.
"Why do you bother me?"
the face asked at the empty room before the mirror. Drizzt took another step to the side, further away from the apparition's line of sight. He considered confronting the mysterious mage, but figured that his friends had too much at stake for him to take such a reckless chance.
"Stand before me, Bigrin!"
commanded the image. It waited for several seconds, sneering impatiently and growing increasingly tense.
"When I discover which of you idiots inadvertently summoned me, I shall turn you into a coney and put you in a pit of wolves!"
The image screamed wildly. The mirror flashed suddenly and returned to normal. Drizzt scratched his chin and wondered if there was anything more he could do or discover here. He decided that the risks were simply too great at this time. When Drizzt returned through the lair, he found Wulfgar sitting with Gwenyvar in the main passage, just a few yards from the closed and barred front doors. The barbarian stroked the cat's muscled shoulders and neck.
"I see that Gwenyvar has won your friendship," Drizzt said as he approached.
Wulfgar smiled.
"A fine ally," he said, giving the animal a playful shake. "And a true warrior."
He started to rise, but was thrown violently back to the floor. An explosion rocked the lair as a ballista bolt slammed into the heavy doors, splintering their wooden bar and blasting them in. One of the doors broke cleanly in half, and the other's top hinge tore away, leaving the door hanging awkwardly by its twisted bottom hinge. Drizzt drew his scimitar and stood protectively over Wulfgar as the barbarian tried to regain his balance. Abruptly, a bearded fighter leaped onto the hanging door. A circular shield, its standard a mug of foaming ale, slung over one arm, and a notched and blood-stained battle axe poised in the other.
"Come out and play, giants!" Brunner called, banging his shield with his axe, as if his clan hadn't already made enough noise to rouse the lair.
"Rest easy, wild dwarf," Drizzt laughed. "The Verbeeg are all dead."
Brunner spotted his friends and hopped down into the tunnel, soon followed by the rest of the rowdy clan.
"All dead?" the dwarf cried. "Damn ye, elf! I knew you'd keep all the play to yourself!"
"What about the reinforcements?" Wulfgar asked.
Brunner chuckled wickedly.
"Some faith, will ye, boy? They're lumped in a common hole, though Beren's too good for him, I say. Only one's alive, a miserable orc who'll breathe only as long as he wags his stinking tongue."
After the episode with the mirror, Drizzt was more than a little interested in interrogating the orc.
"Have you questioned him?" he asked Brunner.
"Ah, he's mum for now," the dwarf replied. "But I've a few things should make him squeal."
Drizzt knew better. Orcs were not loyal creatures, but under the enchantment of a mage, torturing techniques weren't usually much good. They needed something to counteract the magic, and Drizzt had a notion of what might work.
"Go for Regis," he instructed Brunner. "The halfling can make the orc tell us everything we want to know."
"Torturing, it'd be more fun," lamented Brunner.
But he, too, understood the wisdom of the drow's suggestion. He was more than a bit curious and worried about so many giants working together, and now with orcs beside them. Drizzt and Wulfgar sat in the far corner of the small chamber, as far from Brunner and the other two dwarves as they could get. One of Brunner's troops had returned from Lonelywood with Regis that same night. And though they were all exhausted from marching and fighting, they were too anxious about the impending information to sleep. Regis and the captive orc had moved into the adjoining room for a private conversation as soon as the halfling had gotten the prisoner firmly under his control with his ruby pendant. Brunner busied himself preparing a new recipe, giant brain stew, boiling the wretched foul-smelling ingredients right in a hollowed-out Verbeeg skull.
"Use your heads,"
he had argued in response to Drizzt and Wulfgar's expressions of horror and disgust.
"A barnyard goose tastes better than a wild one, 'cause it don't use its muscles. The same ought to hold true for a giant's brains."
Drizzt and Wulfgar hadn't seen things quite the same way. They didn't want to leave the area and miss anything that Regis might have to say, though, so they huddled in the farthest corner of the room, carrying on a private conversation. Brunner strained to hear them, for they were talking of something that he had more than a passing interest in.
"Half for the last one in the kitchen," Wolfgar insisted, "and half for the cat."
"And you only get half for the one at the chasm," Drizzt retorted.
"Agreed," said Wolfgar. "And we split the one in the hall and Brigand down the middle?"
Drizzt nodded. "And with all halves and shared kills added up, it's 10 1/2 for me and 10 1/2 for you."
"And 4 for the cat," added Wolfgar.
4 for the cat," Drizzt echoed. "Well fought, friend. You've held your own up to now. But I've a feeling that we have a lot more fighting before us, and my greater experience will win out in the end."
"You grow old, good elf,"
Wolfgar teased, leaning back against the wall, the whiteness of a confident grin showing through his blonde beard.
"We shall see. We shall see."
Brunner, too, was smiling, both at the good-natured competition between his friends and at his continued pride in the young barbarian. Wolfgar was doing well to keep pace with a skilled veteran like Drizzt Do'Urden. Regis emerged from the room, and the gray pall upon his usually jovial face deadened the light-hearted atmosphere.
"We are in trouble,"
the halfling said grimly.
"Where's the orc?"
Brunner demanded as he pulled his axe from his belt, misunderstanding the halfling's meaning.
"In there. He's all right,"
Regis replied. The orc had been happy to tell its newfound friend everything about Akar Kessel's plans to invade 10 towns and the size of the gathering forces. Regis visibly trembled as he told his friends the news.
"All of the orc and goblin tribes and Verbi clans of this region of the spine of the world are banding together under a sorcerer named Akar Kessel,"
the halfling began. Drizzt and Wolfgar looked at each other, recognizing Kessel's name. The barbarian had thought Akar Kessel to be a huge frost giant when the Verbeek had spoken of him, but Drizzt had suspected differently, especially after the incident at the mirror.
"They plan to attack 10 towns,
Regis continued.
"And even the barbarians, led by some mighty one-eyed leader, have joined their ranks."
Wolfgar's face reddened in anger and embarrassment. His people fighting beside orcs. He knew the leader that Regis spoke of, for Wolfgar was of the tribe of the Elk, and had even once carried the tribe's standard as Hiefstag's herald. Drizzt painfully recalled the one-eyed king, too. He put a comforting hand on Wolfgar's shoulder.
"Go to Bryn Shander," the drow told Brunner and Regis. "The people must prepare."
Regis winced at the futility. If the orc's estimation of the assembling army had been correct, all of 10 towns joined together could not withstand the assault. The halfling dropped his head and mouthed silently, not wanting to alarm his friends any more than was necessary.
"We have to leave."
Though Brunner and Regis were able to convince Cassius of the urgency and importance of their news, it took several days to round up the other spokesmen for council. It was the height of knucklehead season, late summer, and the last push was on to land a big catch for the final trading caravan to Luskin. The spokesmen of the 9 fishing villages understood their responsibilities to their community, but they were reluctant to leave the lakes even for a single day. And so, with the exceptions of Cassius of Bryn Shander, Muldoon, the new spokesman from Lonelywood, who looked up to Regis as the hero of his town, Glensather of Easthaven, the community ever willing to join in for the good of 10 towns, and a Gorwell of Tourmaline, who held fierce loyalty to Brunner, the mood of the council was not very receptive. Kemp, still bearing a grudge against Brunner for the incident over Drizzt after the Battle of Bryn Shander, was especially disruptive. Before Cassius even had the opportunity to present the formalities of order, the gruff spokesman from Targos leaped up from his seat and slammed his fists down on the table.
"Damn the formal readings and be on with it," Kemp growled. "By what right do you order us in from the lakes, Cassius? Even as we sit around this table, the merchants in Luskin are preparing for their journey."
"We have news of an invasion, spokesman Kemp,"
Cassius answered calmly, understanding the fisherman's anger.
"I would not have summoned you, any of you, at this time of the season, if it were not urgent."
"Then the rumors are true,"
Kemp sneered.
"An invasion, you say? Bah, I see beyond this sham of a council.
He turned on Agorwal. The fighting between Targos and Termalane had escalated in the past few 10 days, despite Cassius's efforts to defuse it and bring the principals of the warring towns to the bargaining table. Agorwal had agreed to a meeting, but Kemp was steadfastly against it. And so, with suspicions running high, the timing of this urgent council could not have been worse.
"This is a pitiful attempt indeed," Kemp roared.
He looked around at his fellow spokesman.
"A pitiful effort by Agorwal and his scheming supporters to bring about a favorable settlement for Termalane in their dispute with Targos."
Incited by the aura of suspicion that Kemp had infused, Shermont, the new spokesman from Caer Conic, pointed an accusing finger at Jensen Brent of Caer Denethal.
"What part have you played in this treachery?"
he spat at his bitter rival. Shermont had come into his position after the first spokesman from Caer Conic had been killed on the waters of Lac Dinashir in a battle with a Denethal boat. Doram Lugar had been Shermont's friend and leader, and the new spokesman's policies toward hated Caer Denethal were even more iron-handed than those of his predecessor. Regis and Brunner sat back quietly in helpless dismay through all of the initial bickering. Finally, Cassius slammed his gavel down, snapping its handle in two and quieting the others long enough to make a point.
"A few moments of silence," he commanded. "Hold your venomous words and listen to the messenger of grim tidings."
The others fell back to their seats and remained silent, but Cassius feared that the damage had already been done. He turned the floor over to Regis. Honestly terrified by what he had learned from the captive orc, Regis passionately told of the battle his friends had won over the Verbeeg Lair and on the grass of Daledrop.
"And Brunner has captured one of the orcs that was escorting the giants," he said emphatically.
Some of the spokesmen sucked in their breath at the notion of such creatures banding together, but Kemp and some of the others, ever suspicious of the more immediate threats of their rivals and already decided on the true purpose of the meeting, remained unconvinced.
"The orc told us," Regis continued grimly, "of the coming of a powerful wizard, Akar Kessel, and his vast host of goblins and giants. They mean to conquer 10 towns.
He thought that his dramatics would prove effective. But Kemp was outraged.
"On the word of an orc, Cassius? You summoned us in from the lakes at this critical time on the threat of a stinking orc?"
"The halfling's tale is not an uncommon one," Shermont added. "All of us have heard a captured goblin wag its tongue in any direction it could think of to save its worthless head.
Or perhaps you had other motives,"
Kemp hissed, again eyeing Agorwal. Cassius, though he truly believed the grim tidings, sat back in his chair and said nothing. With tensions on the lakes as high as they were and the final trading fair of a particularly fruitless fishing season fast approaching, he had suspected that this would occur. He looked resignedly at Brunner and Regis and shrugged as once again the council degenerated into a shouting match. Amidst the ensuing commotion, Regis slipped the ruby pendant out from under his waistcoat and nudged Brunner. They looked at it and each other in disappointment. They had hoped that the magical gem wouldn't be needed. Regis pounded his gavel in a call for the floor and was granted it by Cassius. Then, as he had done 5 years previous, he hopped up on the table and walked toward his chief antagonist. But this time the result wasn't what Regis had expected. Kemp had spent many hours over the last 5 years reflecting on that council before the barbarian invasion. The spokesman was glad of the final outcome of that whole situation, and in truth, realized that he and all of 10 towns were indebted to the halfling for making them heed his warning. Yet it bothered Kemp more than a little that his initial stance had been so easily swayed. He was a brawling type whose first love, even above fishing, was battle, but his mind was keen and always alert to danger. He had observed Regis several times over the last few years and had listened intently to tales of the halfling's prowess in the art of persuasion. As Regis approached, the burly spokesman averted his eyes.
"Begone, trickster!"
he growled, shoving his chair defensively back from the table.
"You seem to have a strange way of convincing people of your point of view. but I'll not fall under your spell this time." He addressed the other spokesman. "Ware the halfling. He has some magic about him, be sure."
Kemp understood that he would have no way of proving his claims, but he also realized that he wouldn't have to. Regis looked about, flustered, and unable to even answer the spokesman's accusations. Even a Gorwell, though the spokesman from Tourmaline tactfully tried to hide the fact, would no longer look Regis straight in the eye.
"Sit down, trickster," Kemp taunted. "Your magic's no good once we're on to you."
Brunner, silent up to now, suddenly leaped up, his face contorted with rage.
"Is this too a trick, dog of Targos?"
the dwarf challenged. He pulled a sack from his belt and rolled its contents, a severed Verbeeg head, down the table toward Kemp. Several of the spokesmen jumped back in horror, but Kemp remained unshaken.
"We have dealt with rogue giants many times before," the spokesman replied coolly. "Rogues?" Brunner echoed incredulously. 2 score of the beasts we cut down, orcs and ogres besides." "A passing band," Kemp explained evenly, stubbornly. "And all dead, so you have said. Why then does this become a matter for the council? If it is accolades you desire, mighty dwarf, then you shall have them."
His voice dripped with venom, and he watched Brunner's reddening face with deep pleasure.
"Perhaps Cassius could make a speech in your honor before all of the people of 10 towns.
Brunner slammed his fists onto the table, eyeing all of the men about him in an open threat to anyone who would continue Kemp's insults.
"We have come before ye to help ye save your homes and your kin," he roared. "Might be that ye believe us, and ye'll do something to survive. Or might be that ye'll hear the words of the dog of Targos, and ye'll do nothing. Either way, I've had enough of ye. Do as ye will, and may your gods show ye favor."
He turned and stalked out of the room. Brunner's grim tone brought many of the spokesmen to realize that the threat was simply too grave to be passed off as the deception of a desperate captive, or even as a more insidious plan by Cassius and some conspirators. Yet Kemp, proud and arrogant, and certain that a Gorwell and his non-human friends, the halfling and the dwarf, were using the facade of an invasion to gain some advantage over the superior city of Targos, would not budge. Second only to Cassius in all of 10 towns, Kemp's opinion carried great weight, especially to the people of Caer Conig and Caer Dinneval, who, in light of Bryn Shander's unshakable neutrality in their struggle, sought the favor of Targos. Enough spokesmen remained suspicious of their rivals and were willing to accept Kemp's explanation to prevent Cassius from bringing the council to decisive action. The lines were soon clearly drawn. Regis watched the spectacle as the opposing sides volleyed back and forth, but the halfling's own credibility had been destroyed, and he had no impact on the rest of the meeting. In the end, little was decided. The most that a Gorwell, Glensather and Muldoon could squeeze out of Cassius was a public declaration that a general warning should go out to every household in 10 towns. Let the people know of our grim tidings, and let them be assured that I shall make room within the walls of Bryn Shander for every person who so desires our protection. Regis eyed the divided spokesman. Without unity, the halfling wondered how much protection even the high walls of Bryn Shander could offer.
20. A slave to no man.
"No arguing,"
Brunner snarled. Though none of his 4 friends standing beside him on the rocky slopes of the climb had any intention of speaking against the decision. In their foolish pettiness and pride, the majority of the spokesmen had doomed their communities to almost certain destruction, and neither Drizzt, Wulfgar, Catti Bree, nor Regis expected the dwarves to join in such a hopeless cause.
"When will you block the mines?" Drizzt asked.
The drow hadn't yet decided if he would join the dwarves in the self-imposed prison of their caves, but he had planned to act as scout to Bryn Shander, at least until Akar Kessel's army moved into the region.
"The preparing'll begin tonight," said Brunner. "But once they're in place, we've no rush. We'll let the stinking orcs come right down our throats afore we drop the tunnels, and take 'em in the fall.
Are ye to stay with us, then?
Drizzt shrugged his shoulders. Though he was still shunned by most of the people of Ten Towns, the drow felt a strong sense of loyalty and wasn't sure that he could turn his back on his chosen home, even under suicidal circumstances. And Drizzt had little desire to return to the lightless underworld, even in the hospitable caverns of the dwarven town.
"And what's your decision?"
Brunner asked Regis. The halfling, too, was torn between his instincts for survival and his loyalty to Ten Towns. With the help of the ruby, he had lived well during the last years on Mare Dualden. But now his cover had been stripped away. After the rumors flowing out of the council, everyone in Bryn Shander whispered about the halfling's magical influence. It wouldn't be long before all of the communities heard about Kemp's accusations and avoided, if not openly shunned him. Either way, Regis knew that his days of easy living in Lonelywood were nearing an end.
"Thank you for the invitation," he said to Brunner. "I'll come in before Kessel arrives."
"Good," replied the dwarf. "You'll get a room near the boy, so none of the dwarves has to hear your belly aching."
He flashed Drizzt a good-natured wink.
"Nay,"
said Wulfgar. Brunner looked at him curiously, misunderstanding the barbarian's intentions and wondering why he objected to having Regis beside him.
"Watch yourself, boy," the dwarf teased. "If you're thinking you're to be staying beside the girl, then be thinking about ducking your head from the swing of the axe."
Catty Bree chuckled softly, embarrassed yet truly touched.
"Your minds are not the place for me," Wulfgar said suddenly. "My life is on the plain."
"Ye forget that your life is mine for choosing,"
Brunner retorted. In truth, his yelling was more the short temper of a father than the outrage of a master. Wulfgar rose before the dwarf, proud and stern. Drizzt understood and was pleased. Now Brunner also had an idea of what the barbarian was getting at, and though he hated the thought of separation, he felt more pride in the boy at that moment than ever before.
"My time of indenture is not ended," Wulfgar began. "Yet I have repaid my debt to you, my friend, and to your people many times over. I am Wulfgar," he proudly proclaimed, his jaw firm and his muscles tightened with tension. "No more a boy, but a man. A free man."
Brunner felt the moisture rimming his eyes. For the first time, he did nothing to conceal it. He walked out before the huge barbarian and returned Wulfgar's unyielding stare with a look of sincere admiration.
"So ye are," Brunner observed. "Then might I ask ye, on your choice, if you'll stay and fight beside me?"
Wulfgar shook his head.
"My debt to you is paid in truth, and forever I shall name you as my friend. Dear friend. But I have another debt yet to pay."
He looked out to Kelvin's cairn and beyond. The countless stars shone clearly over the tundra, making the open plain seem even more vast and empty.
"Out there, in another world."
Catty Bree sighed and shuffled uncomfortably. She alone fully understood the vague picture that Wulfgar was painting, and she wasn't pleased with his choice. Brunner nodded, respecting the barbarian's decision.
"Go then, and live well,"
he said, straining to hold his breaking voice even as he moved to the rocky trail. He paused for one last moment and looked back at the tall young barbarian.
"You're a man. There's none to argue that," he said over his shoulder. "But don't ye never forget that ever ye'll be me boy."
"I shan't,"
Wulfgar whispered softly as Brunner disappeared into the tunnel. He felt Drizzt's hand on his shoulder.
"When do you leave?" the drow asked.
"Tonight,"
Wulfgar replied.
"These grim days offer no leisure."
"And where do you go?"
Catty Bree asked, already knowing the truth and also the vague answer that Wulfgar would give. The barbarian turned his misty gaze back out to the plain.
Home.
He started back down the trail, Regis following. But Catti Bree waited behind and motioned for Drizzt to do likewise.
Say your farewells to Wulfgar this night, she told the drow. I do not believe that he shall ever return.
Home is a place for him to choose, Drizzt replied, guessing that the news about Hefstag's joining Kessel had played a part in Wulfgar's decision. He watched the departing barbarian with respect. He has some private matters to attend to.
More than you know,
Catti Bree said. Drizzt looked at her curiously.
Wulfgar has an adventure in mind,
she explained. She hadn't meant to break her trust with Wulfgar, but figured that Drizzt O'Erden, above anyone else, might be able to find a way to help.
One that I believe has been put upon him before he is ready.
Matters of the tribes are his own business, Drizzt said, guessing what the girl was suggesting. The barbarians have their own ways and do not welcome outsiders.
Of the tribes I agree, said Catti Bree. Yet Wulfgar's path, unless I am mistaken, does not lead directly home. He has something else ahead of him, an adventure that he has often hinted at but never fully explained. I only know that it involves great danger, and a vow that even he fears is above his ability to fulfill alone.
Drizzt looked over the starry plain and considered the girl's words. He knew Catti Bree to be shrewd and observant beyond her years. He did not doubt her guesses. The stars twinkled above the cool night, the celestial dome engulfing the flat rim of the horizon, a horizon as yet unmarked by the fires of an advancing army, Drizzt noted.
Perhaps he had time.
Although Cassius's proclamation reached even the most remote of the towns within 2 days, few groups of refugees came down the roads to Bryn Shander. Cassius had fully expected this, or he never would have made the bold offer of sheltering all who would come. Bryn Shander was a fair-sized city, and her present population was not as large as it had once been. There were many vacant buildings within the walls, and an entire section of the city, reserved for visiting merchant caravans, lay empty at the present time. However, if even half of the people of the other 9 communities sought refuge, Cassius would be hard-pressed to honor his pledge. The spokesman wasn't worried. The people of 10 towns were a hardy folk and lived under the threat of a goblin invasion every day. Cassius knew that it would take more than an abstract warning to make them leave their homes. And with the allegiance between the towns at such a low point, few of the town leaders would take any action at all to convince their people to flee. As it turned out, Glensathar and Agorwal were the only spokesmen to arrive at the gates of Bryn Shander. Nearly all of Easthaven stood behind their leader, but Agorwal had less than half of the people of Tourmaline behind him. The rumors from the arrogant city of Targos, itself nearly as well defended as Bryn Shander, made it clear that none of its people would leave. Many of Tourmaline's fishermen, fearing the economic advantage that Targos would gain over them, had refused to give up the most lucrative month of the fishing season. Such was also the case with Caer Conig and Caer Dinaval. Neither of the bitter enemies dared give any edge to the other, and not a single person from either city fled to Bryn Shander. To the people of these embattled communities, the orcs were but a distant threat that would have to be dealt with if it ever materialized. But the fighting with their immediate neighbors was brutally real and evident in all their daily routines. On the western outskirts, the town of Bremen remained fiercely independent of the other communities, viewing Cassius's offer as a feeble attempt by Bryn Shander to reaffirm its position of leadership. Goodmead and Dugan's Hole in the south had no intention of hiding in the walled city or of sending any troops to aid in the fighting. These two towns on Redwaters, smallest of the lakes and poorest in terms of knuckleheads, could not afford any time away from the boats. They had heeded the call for unity 5 years previous, under the threat of a barbarian invasion. And though they had suffered the worst losses of all the towns in the battle, they had gained the least. Several groups filtered in from Lonelywood, but many of the folk of the northernmost town preferred to stay out of the way. Their hero had lost face, and even Muldoon now viewed the halfling in a different light, and passed the warning of invasion off as a misunderstanding, or perhaps even a calculated hoax. The greater good of the region had fallen beneath the lesser personal gains of stubborn pride, with most of the people of Ten Towns confusing unity with dependence. Regis returned to Bryn Shander to make some personal arrangements on the morning after Wulfgar departed. He had a friend coming from Lonelywood with his prized belongings, so he remained in the city, watching in dismay as the days drifted by without any real preparations being made to meet the coming army. Even after the council, the halfling had held out some hope that the people would realize the impending doom and band together. But now he came to believe that the dwarves' decision to abandon Ten Towns and lock themselves into their mines was the only option they had if they wished to survive. Regis partially blamed himself for the coming tragedy, convinced that he had gotten careless. When he and Drizzt had concocted plans to use political situations and the power of the ruby to force the towns into unity against the barbarians, they had spent many hours predicting the initial responses of the spokesman and weighing the worth of each town's alliance. This time, though, Regis had placed more faith in the people of Ten Towns and in the stone, figuring that he could simply employ its power to sway any of the few remaining doubters of the severity of the situation. Yet Regis could not sustain his own guilt as he heard the arrogant and mistrusting responses coming in from the towns. Why should he have to trick the people into defending themselves? If they were stupid enough to let their own pride bring about their destruction, then what responsibility or even what right did he have to rescue them?
"You get what you deserve,"
the halfling said aloud, smiling in spite of himself when he realized that he was beginning to sound as cynical as Brunner. But callousness was his only protection against such a helpless situation. He hoped that his friend from Lonelywood would arrive soon. His sanctuary lay underground. Akkar Kessel sat on the crystal throne in the Hall of Scrying, the third level of Kryshal Tirith, his fingers tapping nervously on the arm of the great chair as he stared intently at the dark mirror before him. Bigrin was long overdue with a report on the reinforcement caravan. The last summons the wizard had received from the lair had been suspicious, with no one on the other end to greet his reply. Now the mirror in the lair revealed only blackness, resisting all of the wizard's attempts to scry out the room. If the mirror had been broken, Kessel would have been able to sense the shift in his visions. But this was more mysterious, for something he could not understand was blocking his distant sight. The dilemma unnerved him, made him think that he had been deceived or discovered. His fingers continued to rap nervously.
"Perhaps it is time to make a decision,"
Ertu, in its customary place at the side of the wizard's throne, suggested.
"We have not yet reached our fullest strength," Kessel retorted. "Many goblin tribes and a large clan of giants have not come in, and the barbarians are not yet ready." "The troops thirst for battle,"
Ertu pointed out.
"They fight with each other. You may find that your army will soon fall apart around you."
Kessel agreed that holding so many goblin tribes together for long was a risky and dangerous proposition. Perhaps it would be better if they marched at once. But still, the wizard wanted to be certain. He wanted his forces at their strongest.
"Where is Bigrin?"
Kessel wailed.
"Why hasn't he answered my summons?" "What preparations are the humans now making?"
Ertu asked abruptly. But Kessel was not listening. He rubbed the sweat from his face. Maybe the shard and the demon had been right about sending the less conspicuous barbarians to the lair. What must the fishermen be thinking if they had found such an unusual combination of monsters lairing in their area? How much had they guessed? Ertu noted Kessel's discomfort with grim satisfaction. The demon and the shard had been pushing Kessel to strike much earlier. As soon as Bigrin's messages had stopped coming in, but the cowardly wizard, needing more assurance that his numbers were overwhelming, had continued to delay.
"Shall I go to the troops?"
Ertu asked, confident that Kessel's resistance was gone.
"Send runners to the barbarians and to the tribes that have not yet joined us," Kessel instructed. "Tell them that to fight beside us is to join in the feast of victory, but those who do not fight beside us shall fall before us. Tomorrow we march."
Ertu rushed from the tower without delay, and soon cheers for the onset of war echoed throughout the huge encampment. Goblins and giants raced excitedly about, breaking down tents and packing supplies. They had anticipated this moment for long 10 days, and now they wasted no time in making the final preparations. That same night, the vast army of Akkar Kessel pulled up its camp and began its long march toward 10 towns. Back in the routed Verbeeg lair, the scrying mirror sat unmoved and unbroken, securely covered by the heavy blanket that Driz Doerden had thrown over it. Epilogue. He ran under the bright sun of day. He ran under the dim stars of the night, ever with the east wind in his face. His long legs and great strides carried him tirelessly, a mere speck of movement in the empty plain. For days, Wulfgar pushed himself to the absolute limits of his endurance, even hunting and eating on the run, stopping only when exhaustion felled him in his tracks. Far to the south of him, rolling out of the spine of the world like a toxic cloud of foul-smelling vapors, came the goblin and giant forces of Akkar Kessel. With minds warped by the willpower of the crystal shard, they wanted only to kill, only to destroy, only to please Akkar Kessel. 3 days out from the Dwarven Valley, the barbarian came across the jumbled tracks of many warriors, all leading toward a common destination. He was glad that he was able to find his people so easily, but the presence of so many tracks told him that the tribes were gathering, a fact that only emphasized the urgency of his mission. Spurred by necessity, he charged onward. It wasn't fatigue but solitude that was Wulfgar's greatest enemy. He fought hard to keep his thoughts on the past during the long hours, recalling his vow to his dead father and contemplating the possibilities of his victories. He avoided any thought of his present path, though, understanding well that the sheer desperation of his plan might well destroy his resolve. Yet this was his only chance. He was not of noble blood, and he had no rights of challenge against Hiefstag. Even if he defeated the chosen king, none of his people would recognize him as their leader. The only way that one such as he could legitimize a claim to tribal kingship was through an act of heroic proportions. He bounded on toward the same goal that had lured many would-be kings before him to their deaths. And in the shadows behind him, cruising with the graceful ease that marked his race, came Driz Doerden. Ever eastward, toward the Reghead Glacier and a place called Evermelt, toward the lair of Ingalakis Timitzilian, the white dragon the barbarians simply called Icing Death. Part 3. Kryshel Tirith. What does Wulfgar see when he looks out over the tundra? When his crystal blue eyes stare across the dark plain to the points of light that mark the fires of his people's encampment? Does he view the past, perhaps, with a longing to return to that place and those ways? Does he view the present, comparing that which he has learned with me and Brunner, with those harsh lessons of life among his nomadic tribesmen? Or does Wulfgar see the future, the potential for change, for bringing new and better ways to his people? A bit of all three, I would guess. That is the turmoil within Wulfgar, I suspect. The simmering fire behind those blue eyes. He fights with such passion, Some of that comes from his upbringing among the fierce tribesmen, the war games of the barbarian boys, often bloody, sometimes even fatal. Part of that passion for battle stems from Wulfgar's inner turmoil, the frustration he must feel when he contrasts his lessons at my hands and at Brunner's hands with those gained in his years among his own people. Wulfgar's people invaded 10 towns, entered with merciless rage, ready to slaughter anyone who stood in their path without regard. How does Wulfgar reconcile that truth with the fact that Brunner Battlehammer did not let him die on the field, that the dwarf saved him, though he tried to kill Brunner in battle, though the foolish young lad made the mistake of swatting Brunner on the head? How does Wulfgar reconcile the love Brunner has shown him against his previous notions of dwarves as hateful, merciless enemies? For that is how the barbarians of Icewind Dale surely view dwarves, a lie that they perpetuate among themselves so they may justify their murderous raiding ways. It is not so different than the lies that the drow tell themselves to justify their hatred of anyone who is not drow. But now Wulfgar has been faced with the truth of Brunner and the dwarves, irrevocably. He must weigh that personal revelation against every truth he spent his years of childhood learning. He must come to accept that what his parents and all the elders of the tribe told to him were lies. I know from personal experience that this is no easy thing to reconcile. For to do so is to admit that a great part of your own life was no more than a lie, that a great part of that which makes you who you are is wrong. I recognized the ills of Menzo Berenzon early on, because its teachings went against logic and went against that which was in my heart. Yet even though those wrongs were painfully obvious, those first steps that carried me out of my homeland were not easy ones. The errors of the barbarians of Icewind Dale pale compared to those of the drow. And so, the steps that Wulfgar must take emotionally away from his people will be even more difficult, I fear. There is far more truth in the ways of the barbarians, more justification for their actions, warlike though they may be. Yet it falls upon Wulfgar's strong but painfully young shoulders to differentiate between the ways of his people and those of his new friends, to accept compassion and acceptance above the solid walls of prejudice that have so encapsulated his entire youth. I do not envy him the task before him, the confusion, the frustration. It is good that he fights every day. I only pray that in a blind fit while playing out that frustration, my sparring companion does not tear the head from my shoulders. Drizzt Do'Urden. 21. The Icy Tomb. At the base of the great glacier, hidden off in a small dell where one of the ice spurs wound through broken rifts and boulders, was a place the barbarians called Evermelt. A hot spring fed a small pool, the warmed waters waging a relentless battle against ice floes and freezing temperatures. Tribesmen stranded inland by early snows, who could not find their way to the sea with the reindeer herd, often sought refuge at Evermelt, for even in the coldest months of winter, unfrozen, sustaining water could be found here, and the warming vapors of the pool made the temperatures of the immediate area bearable, if not comfortable. Yet the warmth and drinking water were only a part of Evermelt's worth. Beneath the opaque surface of the misty water lay a hoard of gems and jewels, gold and silver, that rivaled the treasure of any king in this entire region of the world. Every barbarian had heard of the legend of the White Dragon, but most considered it to be just a fanciful tale recounted by self-important old men for the amusement of children. For the dragon hadn't emerged from its hidden lair in many, many years. Wulfgar knew better, though. In his youth, his father had accidentally stumbled upon the entrance to the secret cave, When Beornigar later learned the legend of the dragon, he understood the potential value of his discovery and had spent years collecting all of the information he could find concerning dragons, especially white dragons, and Ingelokkes Timitzilian in particular. Beornigar had been killed in a battle between tribes before he could make his attempt at the treasure, but living in a land where death was a common visitor, he had foreseen that grim possibility and had imparted his knowledge to his son. The secret did not die with him. Wulfgar felled a deer with a throw of Aegis Fang and carried the beast the last few miles to Evermelt. He had been to this place twice before, but when he came upon it now, as always, its strange beauty stole his breath. The air above the pool was veiled in steam, and chunks of floating ice drifted through the misty waters like meandering ghost ships. The huge boulders surrounding the area were especially colorful, with varying hues of red and orange, and they were encapsulated in a thin layer of ice that caught the fire of the sun and reflected brilliant bursts of sparkling colors in startling contrast to the dull gray of the misted glacier ice. This was a silent place, sheltered from the mournful cry of the wind by walls of ice and rock, free of any distractions. After his father was killed, Wulfgar had vowed, in tribute to the man, to make this journey and fulfill his father's dream. Now he approached the pool reverently, and though other matters pressed in on him, he paused for reflection. Warriors of every tribe on the tundra had come to Evermelt with the same hopes as he. None had ever returned. The young barbarian resolved to change that. He firmed his proud jaw and set to work skinning the deer. The first barrier that he had to overcome was the pool itself. Beneath its surface, the waters were deceptively warm and comfortable, but anyone who emerged from the pool into the air would be frozen dead in minutes. Wulfgar peeled away the hide of the animal and began scraping away the underlying layer of fat. He melted this over a small fire until it attained the consistency of thick paint, then smeared it over every inch of his body. Taking a deep breath to steady himself and focus his thoughts on the task at hand, he took hold of Aegis Fang and waded into Evermelt. Under the deadening veil of mist, the waters appeared serene. But as soon as he moved away from the edges of the pool, Wulfgar could feel the strong, swirling currents of the hot stream. Using a jutting rock overhang as a guidepost, he approximated the exact center of the pool. Once there, he took a final breath and, confident of his father's instructions, opened himself to the currents and let himself sink into the water. He descended for a moment, then was suddenly swept away by the main flow of the stream toward the north end of the pool. Even beneath the mist, the water was cloudy, forcing Wulfgar to trust blindly that he would break free of the water before his breath ran out. He was within a few feet of the ice wall at the pool's edge before he could see the danger. He braced himself for the collision, but the current suddenly swirled, sending him deeper. The dimness darkened to blackness as he entered a hidden opening under the ice, barely wide enough for him to slip through, though the unceasing flow of the stream gave him no choice. His lungs cried for air. He bit down on his lip to keep his mouth from bursting open and robbing him of the last wisps of precious oxygen. Then he broke into a wider tunnel where the water flattened out and dropped below the level of his head. He hungrily gasped in air, but he was still sliding along helplessly in the rushing water. One danger was past. The slide twisted and turned, and the roar of a waterfall clearly sounded up ahead. Wulfgar tried to slow his ride, but couldn't find a handhold or any kind of a brace, for the floor and walls were of ice smoothed under centuries of the flowing stream. The barbarian tossed wildly, Aegis Fang flying from his hands as he futilely tried to drive them into the solid ice. Then he came into a wide and deep cavern and saw the drop before him. A few feet beyond the crest of the fall were several huge icicles that stretched from the domed ceiling down below Wulfgar's line of sight. He saw his only chance. When he approached the lip of the drop, he sprang outward, wrapping his arms around an icicle. He dropped quickly as it tapered, but saw that it widened again as it neared the floor, as though a second icicle had grown up from the floor to meet this one. Safe for a moment, he gazed around the strange cavern in awe. The waterfall captured his imagination. Steam rose from the chasm, adding surrealistic flavor to the spectacle. The stream poured over the drop, most of it continuing on its way through a small chasm, barely a crack in the floor 30 feet below at the base of the fall. The droplets that cleared the chasm, though, solidified as they separated from the main flow of the stream and bounced away.